Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host on today's program, A Business Model to Save the Internet and Journalism. I'll be speaking with Wally Bowen, who's the executive director of the Mountain Area Information Network, and he thinks that nonprofit ISPs may really be the way to go. It should be interesting. Do stay tuned. First up, though, some Media Geek headline news. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin assured the audience at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas that the commission will be investigating complaints about Comcast interfering with its customers' peer-to-peer internet traffic. Speaking on January 8th, Martin said, quote, "Sure, we're going to investigate and make sure that no consumer is going to be blocked," end quote. Back in November, a coalition of consumer groups and legal scholars asked the FCC to stop Comcast's practice of blocking BitTorrent file sharing traffic on its cable modem networks. Furthermore, two of the groups also asked the commission to fine the company $195,000 for every affected customer. Comcast's blocking practices came to light when the Associated Press looked into customer reports of BitTorrent interference and found them to be true. Comcast customers who complained to the company prior to the AP publishing its report say that the company issued flat denials. After the AP report was published, Comcast still denied blocking any traffic, but did admit to delaying some traffic coming from customers running file sharing applications. FCC policy is supposed to support the principle of network neutrality, meaning that all internet traffic is treated equally. However, the commission allows a vague exception for, quote, reasonable traffic management, end quote. Thus, the FCC's investigation into Comcast's BitTorrent blocking will be a real test of what the commission considers reasonable. On January 9th, Comcast responded to Martin's comments, saying that the company will cooperate with the FCC's investigation, but maintaining its denial that it has blocked any internet traffic. In a statement, David Cohen, a Comcast executive vice president, said, quote, "We believe our practices are in accordance with the FCC's policy statement on the internet, where the commission clearly recognized that reasonable network management is necessary for the good of all customers," end quote. While the FCC puts Comcast under the microscope, the House Commerce Committee is doing the same to the FCC. In a letter to Martin, committee chairman John Dingell said the committee has, quote, "initiated a formal investigation into FCC regulatory procedures to determine if they are being conducted in a fair, open, efficient, and transparent manner," end quote. He also warned Martin against destroying electronic records and, quote, "personal emails related to FCC work," end quote. The investigation follows criticisms from both inside and outside Congress about the way Martin handled the lead-up to the commission's December 19th vote to greatly loosen the newspaper TV cross-ownership rule. Even two of Martin's fellow commissioners complained that they did not receive adequate notice of the exact policy changes they would be voting on prior to the night before that December meeting. For his part, Martin says it's business as usual at the FCC, telling reporters, quote, "I was actually at the commission as a staffer when there were Democratic commissioners and a Democratic chairman, and we run the processes in the same way they were run at the time," end quote. And now some sad news about community radio. A fire broke out in the studios of community station KOOP in Austin, Texas, overnight between January 5th and 6th, causing $100,000 in damage to the building and $200,000 in damage to equipment. The Austin Fire Department believes that the fire was intentionally set, but has released no further details. Andrew Dickens, president of KOOP, is offering a $5,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of an arson suspect. The blaze happened 2 years after two fires at the station's previous home caused a total of $600,000 in damage and took the station off the air for a week. A first fire on January 4th, 2006 was caused by smoking materials in an apartment below the station's studios. The second, on February 6, 2006, was caused by the malfunction of a heating and air conditioning unit on the first floor of a nearby club. Both of these fires were ruled to be accidental. KOOP was founded in 1994, splitting time on 91.7 FM with the University of Texas student station KVRX. Aside from fires, the station has seen its fair share of internal struggles over its direction. The most prominent conflict culminated in the firing of the station's founder, Jim Ellinger, in 1999. Ellinger held a press conference outside the KOOP studios on January 7th, telling reporters, quote, "In my opinion, the reason KOOP radio keeps burning down is their own bad karma. They treat people really bad, myself included," end quote. In a statement posted to the KOOP website, Andrew Dickens, the station's president, said, quote, "We will not be silenced. We're not going to be intimidated or scared. We're not going to allow someone to squelch radio for the community by the community. We're going to get back on the air ASAP, and we're going to rebuild. We will take all appropriate measures to protect our volunteer staff and operations. We've been through worse, and we know we have the skills, the determination, and the support of the community," end quote. Well, here's wishing that KOOP can rebuild and get back on the air soon. And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. I'm your host, Paul Reese-Bunnell. Check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. It's the home of the Media Geek blog. And you can get the radio show at radio.MediaGeek.net. You can subscribe to the podcast to get the MP3s automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player, or you can listen right there in your browser, or get the Ogg Vorbis files if that's the way you want to go. It's all there at MediaGeek.net. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@MediaGeek.net. Coming up in just a moment, I'll be speaking with Wally Bowen from the Mountain Area Information Network about a business model to save the internet and journalism. You do want to stay tuned. Welcome back to Media Geek. The Mountain Area Information Network is a nonprofit internet service provider that provides reliable, low-cost internet service, both in Western North Carolina and nationwide, and it's been doing so since 1996. It's a radically different model for getting information and internet service than most of us know. I know certainly I get mine from AT&T. Wally Bowen is the executive director of Mountain Area Information Network, and I should have him on the line. And hello, Wally.
Hey, Paul. It's good to be here. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, thanks so much for being here. So can you tell me more about Mountain Area Information Network and what you're doing?
Well, yeah, as you said, we started operating as a nonprofit internet service provider in 1996. At that time, many of the rural counties here in the mountains of North Carolina had to call long distance to get on the internet. So what we did was put servers in each of the counties and dial-up lines and made the internet accessible with a local phone call. We also put the first public access terminals in public libraries in 12 counties here in Western North Carolina. So that's how we got started. And but that was just the beginning. What we wanted to do was to give citizens and nonprofits and local businesses the option of spending their internet dollars to support local grassroots media. So we now have a low-power FM radio station. We led the effort to get public access TV going in the first public access TV operation in Western North Carolina about 18 months ago here in Asheville. So, and you know, it's all about capturing those digital dollars that are leaving our communities and going to the big media that we're all struggling against. So we feel like it's a very compelling business model. Of course, the challenge facing us now is switching from dial-up to high-speed, and we're doing that through our wireless high-speed network.
And so, I mean, why was it that so many communities there in Western North Carolina didn't have a local dial-up number to get internet access? I think it's something that a lot of people in a lot of communities took for granted even in 1996.
Yeah, I think that was, I don't think that was very uncommon for a lot of rural communities around the country. You know, these folks had, if they called the next county over, it was a long distance phone call. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, people who had an AOL account or a CompuServe account, you know, it was a long distance call to get on the internet. The same for the, a lot of public librarians. I remember going to a reference librarian who had to use call long distance on her AOL account in order to check the internet for a question that I had. So, yeah, that's just, you know, it seems like eons ago, but yeah, in the early 90s, I think that was a fairly common experience for a lot of rural communities.
And very expensive. I mean, at that time, I mean, long distance wasn't as expensive as it was maybe in the 70s, but you were still tacking on that per minute charge on top of whatever you were already paying for internet service.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so that was a huge step for our region back then. And we saw the future, a strong independent ISP sector. And little did we know that, this whole net neutrality issue would come up. Although, I must admit, you and I, just before we went on the air, were talking about Bob McChesney's work about how the public airwaves were taken over in the 1920s, early 30s. I actually did write a piece in 1996 based in part on Bob's research that predicting that if we weren't careful, the Internet would be enclosed, privatized, commercialized by big media, and independent ISPs would go by the wayside. And sure enough, 10 years later, that started happening. So we were intent from the get-go that we had to be an internet service provider. We had to give citizens the option of keeping their dollars local to support alternative media.
And why did you decide to go nonprofit? I mean, why not just simply start up as a small business?
Oh, well, I guess I'm a social change entrepreneur. I didn't know that term until recently, but I could have been in it for building my own personal equity, but my experience was that private sector operations like that eventually sell out and are taken over by non-local entities and become consolidated. And I wanted to create something that was grounded in our community, that was responsible to our community, and couldn't be sold off to a non-local corporate entity. And I'm not going to be around forever. I wanted to create something that would still be in this community beyond my time here.
In a lot of ways, you're building on a great American tradition of local cooperatives, and that, especially in rural areas where, farmers would come together to put together the service they needed. And in fact, it was done for phone service, before there
Absolutely.
Was an AT&T.
Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that. It was not only done for phone service, but rural electrification. Mm-hmm. And it's funny you mention that, because we were under a lot of pressure to leave internet service to the private sector. And I kept pointing to, hey, look at rural electrification, look at rural telephone. We have a legitimate role to play as a nonprofit. We were under attack by a local private internet service provider, a very conservative, in fact, he was former president of the Republican Party here, who felt like that we, what we were doing was simply un-American. It was an infringement on his right to make a profit. And we predicted that, one of these days, Bill, you're going to sell out and, Internet of Asheville will no longer be locally owned. And sure enough, he took the golden parachute and sold out and bought a radio station. And now Internet of Asheville has been bought and sold several times over, and I was talking to a friend of mine who still uses that email address, and I said, Ken, where does Internet of Asheville reside these days? Who owns it? He said, I have no idea. It's been bought and sold so many times. So our goal was to, again, create some social equity and infrastructure that would not leave our community.
And just a question, this other guy who did Internet of Asheville, what was he providing the same local dial-up service to these communities that otherwise had to call long distance? Were you competing with him there?
Well, actually, he came out and started competing with us in the rural counties. He was already in Asheville, and of course, he wanted to expand his business and build it. And
I thought competition was the way of the modern economy.
Yeah, but you see, because we were eligible for grants, even though we were not a government entity, we were eligible for grants, and our first grant was from the U.S. Department of Commerce, and he just thought it was un-American and unfair competition, and he wouldn't accept any the argument that I wasn't profiting, this equity that we're building, I don't own it. I'm not going to pass it down to my heirs. The equity he's building, it's his to do what he pleases with. He can pass it on to his children or sell it or whatever. I mean, we're two different animals. We were not a government agency, competing against him. We were a private sector nonprofit, and so we weathered that storm, and as we predicted, he eventually sold out and went away. But there was another community network that we helped us get started. It was called Charlotte's Web in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And they started out as an ISP, but they said, this is something we need to leave to the private sector. And it wasn't but two or three years later that they went belly up, and Charlotte's Web now is owned by the Charlotte Observer, and it really is not a functioning community organization at all. It's simply a website that's rarely visited.
So it's about a dozen years or so later, and you're still going and going strong. What's been the key to maintaining Mountain Area Information Network and growing it?
Well, I think, we live in a community here in a region where there's a lot of consciousness about keeping dollars local and just doing things, for yourself rather than depending on some non-local corporation there's just, a growing consciousness about self-sufficiency and buying local, and so we definitely benefited from that growing consciousness. We've also done a good job of telling our story. Of course, we eventually got a radio station.
Mm-hmm.
We were out there working very hard. It took us over a decade to get public access TV off the ground. And we were, having community meetings. We just got out in the community and told our story. And just built that base of support over the years. I must say, though, the last few years have been kind of tough because with some of the regulatory decisions coming out of Washington, we've been losing our dial-up subscriber base very, very dramatically. We went from 5,000 dial-up subscribers just 4 or 5 years ago to about 1,500 now.
Wow.
Yeah, and then we were not allowed to resell high-speed internet over the phone system, the DSL. We're not allowed to resell cable modem high-speed internet. And so that leaves us with only with wireless technology, and the spectrum that's available to us is very, very marginal and overused. And so our big challenge, and the challenge I believe facing the future of the internet and the future of journalism, is spectrum reform. Getting access, reclaiming some of the public airways for non-commercial, local community use. And I'm very hopeful about that, winning that battle.
Now, I take it that broadband is available in the metropolitan sort of Asheville area, but is it yet available in a lot of the more rural areas? perhaps more the ones at higher elevations?
Only where the cable or telephone companies have expanded and made it available. But there are still many people who live in more remote areas, even in Asheville, that cannot get DSL and they cannot get high-speed cable. And for folks out, you know, in some of these more rural counties, there's a lot of folks who still can't get, you know, they're looking at satellite, it's very expensive, that's not an option, and, you know, there is a serious rural broadband problem, access problem in this country that needs to be addressed, and the good news is that there is spectrum that is vacant, it's not being used, it belongs to us, the people, the public airwaves, but it's currently held by the TV broadcasters.
Right.
And so the Wireless Innovation Act of 2007, which is pending in Congress, would would open up some of these, they're called white spaces, because they're blank, they're vacant, they're not being used. And with today's smart digital technology, we could deliver blanket high-speed internet in rural areas from a single antenna out to 30 miles, never interfering with the local TV broadcaster. And given how critical it is to get high-speed internet out to low-wealth communities and rural communities, we need to pass this legislation. But the TV, you know, National Association of Broadcasters, they're not going to give it up easily.
No, and they're supposed to when they change over to digital, because this is their old analog spectrum that they're giving up. But I know
of that spectrum is being sold off later month. That's a 700 megahertz spectrum.
That's
a whole other corrupt initiative put forth by this FCC and by the Republican Congress. We had hopes that some of that 700 megahertz spectrum might be set aside for wholesale use by independent ISPs, but it's not going to happen. So that leaves the white space spectrum that they still control, but again, they're not using it. They want to warehouse it for future speculation. I need to remind people that they don't rent this spectrum. They don't own it. They've never paid a dime for it.
Mm-hmm.
They've had the use of it for more than 50 years since they originally got licenses back in the 50s. It's one of the greatest corporate subsidies in the history of this country that we don't talk about. And it's time for them to give a little bit back to the local communities and to non-commercial, unlicensed use.
And so you believe that if some of this white space were allocated for nonprofit ISPs, certainly,
and not just nonprofits, for commercial ISPs,
so just
for independent ISPs,
to use for local internet service all around. Certainly, Mountain Area Information Network would be able to use it, and you think that lots of other ISPs around the country would be able to use it as an alternative to DSL or cable.
It would reinvigorate the independent ISP sector, which has just been decimated by the enclosure of the internet by the cable and telephone companies.
Indeed. So at Mountain Area Information Network, you'd have no problem with the concept of net neutrality, I'm guessing.
Well, we need net neutrality. We need it desperately, because the control that the cable and phone companies now have over our free speech over the internet, over our privacy, economic innovation, technological innovation, the fact that Apple had to cut a deal with AT&T to get the iPhone to market is just one example of the need for net neutrality. My concern is that Congress will probably, I see net neutrality being blocked in Congress in terms of a wholesale regulatory action, implementation by congressional action. I see the real path, and the most direct path to real net neutrality, by creating competition in the internet marketplace, by creating a third pipe, a third way through this wireless, more efficient wireless spectrum that we can use, that independent ISPs like us can use. And that gives folks an alternative and will probably pressure the cable and telephone companies to abide by net neutrality, net neutral protocols. And otherwise, I think we're going to see net neutrality blocked in Congress because they're going to frame it, that is the cable and telephone industries, they're going to frame it as you know, is Congress going to favor Google and Microsoft, or are they going to favor, you know, it's the one set of Goliaths versus another set, and that's the strategy they're using. And of course, Congress is going to do what Congress often does, is that they're going to water it down, they're going to compromise, or either they're going to not act, and 2 or 3 years down the road, we still don't have net neutrality.
Right,
but if we get this, we get spectrum reform, and we create opportunities for new ISPs to go into business or to be resurrected, then we create a market, some market competition. And I don't see how any conservative or libertarian or anyone could object to that. That's what people are always preaching. Let's do it.
I agree. Let's do it. So what's the name of that bill again regarding the white spaces?
The Wireless Innovation Act of 2007.
Okay, and that's something that that you're saying, boy, we hope we can get some momentum behind in Congress.
Exactly, exactly. My one concern I have, though, is that it's being framed as a mobile devices bill. Because one of the benefits of this legislation is that it will create the potential for people to have mobile Internet access, and that's terrific. But if you're still using dial-up, mobile Internet access is not what you think a lot about. You just want to have high speed there to your desktop. And so the problem is what we're seeing the National Association of Broadcasters doing is that they're going to some of these rural legislators, and they did it to our member of Congress, and saying, you're going to have all these city folks up here with their Blackberries interfering with your local TV reception. And and completely obscuring the rural broadband problem,
right.
And that this is the solution to that problem.
Well, I wish we had more time, but we're coming up here on the end of the show. I really thank you for coming on and talking about this.
Great.
I hope we can talk some more as things go along, because I think there's...
Well, please direct folks to our website, main.nc.us, and click on Save the Net. I have a long essay there.
It's a great essay.
It's well-documented. About the third pipe, and about how this would be a solution to the collapse of journalism.
Yes, it's a great essay. I really enjoyed it. I think it's really good. I'm going to post it up to the Media Geek website at mediageek.net.
Right.
Once again, Wally, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Paul.
This brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with more news and views in our media environment. In the meantime, check out the Media Geek blog at mediageek.net. You can listen to and download the program at radio.mediageek.net, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. If you have any comments about the program, I'd love to read them. Send them to paul@mediageek.net. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and also is heard on 12 other community stations across North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, KWMD in Kosilov in Anchorage, Alaska, Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, CHMA in Sackville, New Brunswick, WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. The Media Geek Radio Show is available for free to any non-commercial community station. Just send email to paul@mediageek.net. Thanks for tuning in.